less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Begin countdown. Six, five, four, three, two, one.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody. Yes, this is the Guy James Show, coming to you from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida, Fort Myers, Naples area, and of course all around the country, all around the world via the World Wide Web. And we welcome you to the show today. We've got a great show lined up for you. It's good to be back in the home studio after being gone last week. We've got a couple of great interviews coming up at the bottom of the hour. We've got Stephen Marks, who wrote a great book, should be an interesting interview, called Confessions of a Political Hitman, My Secret Life of Scandal, Corruption, Hypocrisy, and Dirty Attacks That Decide Who Gets Elected and Who Doesn't. Stephen Marks, that's going to be good. And in the second hour, we've got Dr. Heidi Hartman with us from the Institute of Women's Policy Research in Washington, and she's going to talk to us about this so-called stimulus package that the White House and the House are working out right as we speak. It be interesting to see how that comes out. Do have to remember, right after the show today, to go vote. We are having a primary today, kind of, well, as they've mentioned on TV, it's pretty much just a beauty contest for we Democrats today. The delegates aren't going to be assigned, so I hope a lot of people aren't going to say, oh, what the hell, I'm not going to go vote. I hope they do. Get out there and vote. And Hillary's supposed to win that one easily, from what I understand. And then the Republicans, man, oh man, is Romney and McCain, are they ever throwing mud at one another? Wow. Wow. Calling each other liberals. You know, all we hear in the press is all about Clinton and Obama fighting. And here we've got this dirty, nasty campaign going on between Romney and McCain. And they're all over the place. They were both here yesterday, here locally, stopped at the airplane hangar out of Southwest Florida Regional International Airport, and gave a little speech out there. Giuliani was here. Man, Giuliani isn't drawing any crowds. I think Giuliani's about done for. We shall see. Today we'll find out whether he's done for or not, but do have to remember to get out there and vote today. I think I got till 6 o'clock, so it's just up the road from the studio. Won't take any time at all. Hey, I do want to take a moment and thank all the folks at Health Action 2008, the conference we went to last week. That's put on by Families USA. A great conference. I especially want to thank LaVisa Frost and Dave Lemon and the whole gang there. Just great people to work with. And, of course, it's always good to get together with our radio friends, Peter B. Collins and John Elliott and Arnie Arneson and Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News, and a good friend of ours, Susie Turnbull, the vice chair of the DNC, and Candy Stroud from Stroud and Associates that helped put the whole thing together, and our friend Stephen Crockett. It was just a lot of fun to be there and talk to all those folks, sit around when we had a few spare moments, and believe me, it's work going at those We attend round tables. I'm suffering a cold today here. Hang on with me. If you hear the silence for a minute, I'm hitting the old cough button. But we get together and have informal chats in some of the side rooms from the seminars in the morning, and it's great to exchange ideas, what we talk about on the radio, and it's great to talk with some of the political insiders and find out what really goes on in Washington when we're not there. Always very, very interesting, and it is good to talk to the people from the DNC and other great organizations around the country. I learned so much from the conference this week. It just was overwhelming, and it's wonderful to know that there are thousands and thousands of good people all over this country who are immersed in helping solve our health care problem, and it is a problem, a big problem. And it can be solved, and it must be solved. And it will be. It will be. Also, I want to mention, had dinner with Billy Shears and his lovely wife, Maria, on Friday evening, I think it was. Yeah, Friday evening. Had great dinner. They're great people. Of course, Billy, the music director of this program, he and his wife are just absolutely fabulous folks. They live up in the Baltimore area, and they drove down to the Mayflower, and we met and went out to dinner. It was just a great time. Always look forward to seeing folks we know. I can tell you that the Airborne ad that you see on TV, these tablets you take or powder you take and put in your drink to keep from getting colds and so forth on airplanes, it doesn't work. No. I had some from a recent plane trip on, I think it was JetBlue. I think it's JetBlue that passes it out. I had some packets from them, and I had some that I bought at the drugstore here a while back. Anyway, I took it on the way up, and I took it on the way back, just the way I'm supposed to, and I ended up with a great damn cold anyway. So much for that Airborne stuff. So I sound a little stuffed up today. I am. I told somebody on the chat room I'm getting to be a real wuss. Go up to Washington, and of course we live here in Southwest Florida, and we don't have severe weather, cold, or anyway, don't even have severely hot weather. Some of you might think so when you come down here in the summer and it's 95 degrees, but it's not really severe. The hassle. I mean, we go to Washington, and at night it was, I don't know, maybe 25 degrees and windy. You know, it's always breezy. And it got a little cold, but you know what the hassle is? Somebody lives in a tropical climate like this, and you go north in the wintertime and it's cold. Coats. What a hassle! Carrying a coat, a place to hang your coat. When you go in a restaurant, if there's no place to hang it, you got to drape it over your seat and hope it doesn't fall off. And just coats, putting them on, taking them off. You're hot, you're cold. Oh, coats. Well, anyway, have I done enough bitching? I think so. And I hope a lot of you got to hear the programs while we're there. Normally we're not on Friday, and we were this week. And by the way, I'm told that if it's not up already, we'll make sure it gets up on WhiteRoseSociety.org. The interview with Jack Burkhart and Julian Epstein on Friday was one of the most fun times I've ever had doing radio. Of course, those of you that have a keen eye for some of the talk shows on TV know that Julian Epstein is a longtime Democrat. He's a Democratic strategist, been involved with the House Investigative Committee and all that. Jack Burkhart is a hardcore Republican activist he's a hardcore Republican, and he's on Tweety Bird show all the time. I think old Bowtie Boy has him on now and then. But Jack really won't give an inch. Just won't give an inch. And I think you probably heard him say he thought George Bush is one of our great presidents. And of course, had to go on and make the statement that the stimulus package, handing out money to people who don't have anything. First, we got to, you know, the old Republican talking points. Got to make sure these people don't go out and buy plasma TVs. That's the first thing coming out of the Republicans' mouth these days. Yeah, they'll just take it out and blow it on plasma TVs. God, I get tired of that. Don't you? I think they want to, along with all the spying they want to do on us on the internet and our phones and with cameras at every street corner and that, I think they'd be happy to have some sort of a, you know, here we have Republicans who say they loathe big government, but, you know, they don't loathe Big Brother, now do they? No. And so it would be a good thing to build a new building in Washington, D.C., a big high-rise with many floors, building maybe the size of the Pentagon, fill it full of spies, and go out and spy on people. Make sure that if they get any public assistance that they don't have a plasma TV or a fancy car or anything that that Republicans might gripe about if you were getting any public aid of any kind. God, I get tired of that kind of talk. I really do. Love to have you join the program today, 866-546-5254. You're more than welcome to call, 866-546-5254. That's toll-free. And if you should desire to call us with your unlimited minutes that you have, 941-876-6896. 941-876-6896. Too many numbers to remember these days. I've got to mention this. I got a couple of things I want to mention. I got a letter from a listener, an email today, a Ron Paul disciple, calling me a liar because I haven't mentioned that Hillary Clinton has garnered the most money from the military contractors. Have I not mentioned that? I think she's also maybe got the most from the pharmaceuticals as well. I think we've discussed all that on the program. And, you know, there was some sort of inference that I'm protecting Hillary Clinton, I guess. He said I was a liar for, quote, withholding that information from my listeners. And maybe I haven't mentioned on the show that I think Ron Paul is a disgusting little sleazebag either, but does that make me a liar? I'm not going to sit here day after day and bring up every negative thing I know about any of the candidates. God knows there's plenty of it out there. We don't have time nor the inclination to bring it all up on this program. And God knows I certainly haven't begun to scratch the surface of what negative things I know about Ron Paul. And I don't intend to. But does that make me a liar? You know, you can disagree with me on any issue anytime you want. But as for calling me a liar, that's just plain untrue. I have never, never misled my listeners intentionally about anything. And I've made mistakes, and when I've discovered that, I've always said something, and, you know, if I've said something in error, I've always tried to correct my mistakes. But anyway, the liar thing got under my skin, and there are plenty of adjectives you can use when describing me, but liar isn't one of them. And so, you know, someone calls and wants to complain about what I say on the show just because I'm not a Ron Paul aficionado. I do think Ron Paul's a little sleazebag. I've pretty much said so on this program. I will not help Ron Paul's campaign in any way whatsoever. I don't have anything good to say about him. Yes, he wants to stop the war. He's used that. He's running as a Republican, and he wants to stop the war, and that's a good thing. We all know that's a good thing. But in order to try and get himself, I think he just does it in order to get himself favor with the public so he can push all the rest of his crazy, insane, radical views on the rest of the country. So there I've said my piece, and you don't need to send me any more letters calling me a liar about what I said about Ron Paul. There you have it. There are no doubts what I think about Ron Paul. I do think he's a little sleazebag, you know, I'm not going to help his campaign in any way, shape, or form. I would not ever. I will not. And as far as withholding information, that's ludicrous. If we have information about anybody that we think is interesting and we have time to put it out, we do. That's what we do. And I don't think anybody could accuse me on this program of not letting the Democrats have it when they need it and letting the Republicans have it too, as well as those crazy damn libertarians also. So don't bother to send me any more email like that. And, you know, threatening me, you know, trying to, threatening isn't the right word. As you know, this show survives on donations and listener contributions. And believe me, we appreciate your financial support for the show, but financial support for the show is waning. And I've received word from several of you that times are tough and you can't participate anymore. I understand that. And I thank you for the help that you have given. We're in real need of funds to continue the show. We don't waste a dime of your gifts to the program. Our trips to Washington, for example, are always taken care of completely by the organizations that invite us for their radio rows. Not a penny of your money. And we really need your help with the program right now. The candidates are sucking up all the money that's out there. And it's very tough for small organizations to get by at the moment. So do consider helping with the show. But, you know, when we get a subscriber that calls the show and then, you know, thinks that's going to sway my opinion in one way or another, it does not. I think if people want to support the show, they should do so because it's heartfelt and because they believe in what we're doing. And if you send me a note calling me a liar and withdraw your support from the program, do you think that makes me look bad? It doesn't. It makes you look absolutely foolish. So there, I've said it. Enough of that. 866-546-5254. We do have a lot to talk about today. We'll talk about the State of the Union speech last night. Certainly, much to talk about there. And, of course, this stimulus package that they've got up in front of the House, and they're negotiating on it right now. Let me ask you, did you watch the State of the Union speech last night? I did. I didn't want to, but I did. I thought the craziest thing that was said all evening was said by Chris Matthews. What is wrong with him? What is wrong with Chris Matthews? I have to wonder. Did you notice that before Junior got up and started his speech, Matthews said what's her name? Laura Bush, when she came in, she had some sort of a red dress, was sitting up in the gallery, and Matthews saw her coming in and said, oh, you know, she's managed to avoid all the controversy and everything of her husband, and she's such an intelligent woman. She reads. I thought, yeah. That was his comment about the woman. You know, she's intelligent, and she reads. I guess he's so used to having to comment about the husband that doesn't read, maybe can't, I don't know. But that was a big thing. She reads. And did you notice that Mr. Pro-Life himself, the one that represents the hardcore right of the right-wing party, the Republicans, and the theocracy that they're trying to get going, and Pat Robertson and Dobson and that whole group, the rabid pro-life group that wants to tell you what to do, wants to tell all the ladies listening to this show and all the ladies in the country, wants to tell them what they must do and what they cannot do, that he said last night during his speech, Junior did, and let me quote him, "We will help ensure that decisions about your medical care are made in the privacy of your doctor's office, not in the halls of Congress." Well, I don't suppose that whoever wrote that speech thought about what that might sound like to people who are decidedly pro-choice. But what does it sound like to you? "We will help ensure that decisions about your medical care are made in the privacy of your doctor's office, not in the halls of Congress." Well, that's exactly, Mr. Bush, what we've been trying to do. That's exactly why we want to keep you from appointing one more Supreme Court justice and swinging the Roe v. Wade over in your favor. We want to make sure that decisions about medical care are made in the privacy of your doctor's office, not in the halls of Congress. And yet, for how many years now, for how many years you've used that as a club against the left? Silly. And all the nicey-nice stuff last night, I'm sure you all notice it. Nicey-nice, just one big happy family in the House chamber last night. Everybody's just getting along so well, you know, shaking Mr. Bush's hand. One of them, who was it, Chris Shays? I even saw Representative Chris Shays give Bush a kiss on the cheek. Now, wasn't that special? But they're just one big happy family, and they're happy, all right. They ought to be. They're all making big bucks for a part-time job. They've all got great health care. They ought to be very happy. And I've been to two or three of those, I guess two of those State of the Union deals, and they're just it's a glorious night for politicians, just slapping each other on the back and smiling and grinning. Some of these people hate one another and yet they go put on a big show for the State of the Union, for the cameras at home and for their people back home. Kind of makes me sick, to tell you the truth. Bush shaking hands with people he doesn't give the time of day to otherwise. I mean, and, of course, Republicans getting up and hooting and hollering on everything that Bush says. And who didn't know what he was going to talk about last night? Who didn't know? We knew that tax breaks, tax breaks, tax breaks was going to be coming up over and over again, and certainly it did. And, you know, when you talk about giving out tax cuts and tax breaks to corporations and so forth, you know, I don't care how many tax breaks you give to a corporation, particularly manufacturers, people that sell goods or services. If you give them tax breaks, I don't care how many tax breaks you give them. If a consumer doesn't have money to buy the product, it's not going to help. You get all the tax breaks in the world, but if the consumer can't buy your product, that's the wrong way to stimulate the economy. And the Republicans have mentioned it over and over and over again over the years that tax cuts leads to more revenue, and there's not a shred of evidence to prove that. There's a little anomaly here and an anomaly there, but on a consistent basis, tax cuts for the rich do not enhance the revenue for the U.S. government. It doesn't work that way. And yet we hear that over and over and over again from the Bush administration. And, you know, Bush talks about, cooperation from the Democrats. It's as though everything that's happened in this country in the last 7 years, everything that's wrong is the problem of the Democrats. He said, I've submitted judicial nominees who will rule by the letter of the law, not by the whim of the gavel, and many of these nominees are being unfairly delayed. They're worthy of confirmation, and the Senate should give each of them a prompt up or down vote. The fact is that the Democratic-led Congress has confirmed more of Bush's judges than during the GOP Congress. That's right. The Democratic Congress has okayed more of his judges than the Republicans did when they had control of the Congress. And even though they lost control of the Senate, the Republicans, 40 of Bush's judges won confirmation this year. That's more than in the previous 3 years when the Republicans had the majority. So what's the beef here? All political BS. And talking about the uninsured. He said we share a common goal, making health care more affordable and accessible for all Americans, and the best way to achieve that goal is by expanding consumer choice, not government control. So I proposed ending the bias in the tax code against those who do not get their health insurance through their employer. This one reform would put private coverage within reach for millions, and I call on Congress to pass it this year, end quote. Well, the fact is, the number of uninsured Americans has consistently and constantly increased during the Bush administration. The number of uninsured Americans rose for the sixth consecutive year in 2006. 47 million people uninsured. And the number of uninsured kids rose for the second straight year to 8.7 million. He's done nothing for that. He's done nothing to make sure people insured, to help see that people insured. He's done nothing. And all that falderal he went on about last night with the about the earmarks. The fact is, federal earmarks have absolutely exploded under the Bush and the Republican-led Congress. And Bush said last night, the people's trust in their government is undermined by congressional earmarks, special interest projects that are often snuck in at the last minute without discussion or debate. The fact is, Bush has engaged in his own earmarking. His. In 2007, Bush put in 580 earmarks worth $15.6 billion. Things like $24 million for Laura Bush's 21st Century Librarian Program, and $8.9 million for the Points of Light Foundation, a pet project started by his father. And he signed one pork bill after another that's come to him. So don't let him sit here and tell you that, well, these Democrats are responsible for all these earmarks and blowing all this money. Quite the contrary is the truth. You know, the GOP always accuses the Democrats of being the tax and spend liberals. That is when they're not accusing them of being unpatriotic. And the fact is, the GOP is the party of don't tax, but spend anyway. And isn't it strange that while, you know, this mortgage debt bubble was growing, and everybody knew it was, and so is the national debt, you know, somebody's got to pay sometime. But yet, he's encouraged more tax cuts for the wealthy. Well, I'm not an economist, but I do understand that the bills have to be paid. I do understand we have to have enough revenue coming in to pay them. And I do understand when we're already running a deficit, we don't have enough money to pay our bills, that cutting the revenues is just simply not going to do the job. We're going to pause for a break. We'll be back.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
If you can stand it, I can. Play it.
Howdy, Rangers. Tune in to Rick's Place. You'll be fascinated with porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner's take on all of today's political issues from a real Texas liberal point of view. So mosey on into Rick's Place for some good old hospitality with Rick Goodner. See you there, Rangers, this Saturday right here on the head-on radio network, The Horn.
And if you want another kind of love,
Rick's Place with Rick Goodner, part of the weekend lineup on The Horn, running all weekend in rotation with The Showers Report and Night Sounds.
If you ever leave me, I'll be sad and blue. Don't you ever leave me, I'm so in love with you.
The birds in the sky would be sad and lonely if they knew that I lost my one and only. They'd be sad if you're bad to me. The leaves on the trees would be softly sighing if they heard from the breeze that you left me crying. They'd be sad. Don't be bad. But I know you won't leave me, 'cause you told me so. And I've no intention of letting you go. Just as long as you let me know, you won't be bad to me. So the birds in the sky won't be sad and lonely, 'cause they know that I've got my one and only. They'll be glad you're not bad to me.
right, we're back. Welcome back to the Guy James Show, everybody. Thanks for staying with us, and thanks for being with us today here on this Tuesday, primary day here in Florida, big day, and all across the country next week with the Super Tuesday coming up. I know everybody's chomping at the bit, ready to get out and cast their votes and decide what kind of candidates we're going to have coming up. As promised, right now, though, I do want to tell you that we've got an interesting guy on the phone right now. His name is Stephen Marks. Stephen is the author of a new book out called Confessions of a Political Hitman. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Guy. I really appreciate it.
I got to tell you, this is one of the more interesting books I've read in a long time. It's got it all. I went to Washington last week. I read it all the way up and all the way back on the plane.
Wow, thanks.
And finished it up very recently. And this book has got a little bit of everything in it. we'll get into it. What caused you to write this book?
You know, it's funny. Opposition research, which is, of course, the euphemism that we use in Washington for digging up dirt on your opposing candidate, also digging up dirt on your own candidate to find out what kind of areas the other side is going to attack us on. It's a part of politics that no one's really ever written about this, specifically an opposition researcher, somebody, an insider that's done this type of work. And to me, it's just such an important part of politics, and I really believe the American people needed to know how this process works, why it works, or why it sometimes doesn't work. And I became kind of disillusioned with the whole process myself, and I thought the best thing to do would be to just set up this election cycle and instead write a book about it.
Well, let's set up for the listeners exactly what it is you do. Now, there's a political race going on between Congressman X and his challenger, and you are contacted by Congressman X, and he says, I want you to do what about my challenger?
Okay, generally what we do, the first area we look at is their public record. If they were a congressman, you would go to the Library of Congress or congressional record, look through every one of their votes for something that would be politically damaging. For instance, any time that they've raised taxes, say they were soft on crime, depending on what state you're in, where they went on social issues like abortions and guns, depending on what state you were in, if they were in the South, for instance, if they were pro-choice, that would be bad, or if they were against guns, that would be bad. If you were in a northern liberal state, the opposite. And going through all their quotes, things they've said on the House floor or the Senate floor, again, looking for something that would hurt them politically. Then we have a newspaper database, which I'm sure you're familiar with, LexisNexis, where you can put that person's name and find out everything that's been written in the paper, including quotes. Hopefully you can find something that will, again, hurt them politically. The second level of research is going to the county, wherever they're from, any place they've ever lived or done business, checking out for lawsuits against them or their business, checking out any criminal charges against them, any late taxes, liens, et cetera, nasty divorces, anything where you can find something that could be used against them politically. And every campaign and every political action committee and every 527 group hires a political hitman or an opposition researcher to dig up this stuff. For, you know, just for instance, when you were watching Hillary and Obama in their little shouting match last week in a debate, all the stuff that they were throwing at each other, they got that information from their opposition research person or team or their political hitman, as you will.
Is there anything that's off limits?
Well, fortunately, the experience of Bill Clinton and the Monica Lewinsky scandal has made sex now off limits. Not because it's really off limits, but simply it doesn't work anymore. And basically, will boomerang if you try to hit somebody with that. Anything involving their family members or their religion. Now, what's interesting with the religious thing, the general rule, you attack somebody's religion at your own peril. It will also normally boomerang, but as you see, the Clintons are already leaking this stuff about Obama's church because there's a racial element in it. The pastor there has said some anti-white things, and whether that will backfire or not, it's hard to tell. But Clinton has immunized politicians in the future from any sexual stuff because if you bring it up, it's just going to backfire. Just for one example, in 2000, the Gore people did poll the issue on George W. Bush because there were rumors of sexual stuff and drugs in his background, and they found out that when they polled it, the people did not want to hear about it, just like they didn't want to hear about Bill Clinton. So, of course, the Gore folks didn't use it because it just would have humanized Bush as it did humanize Clinton.
Hmm. You use Bill Clinton as the standard for all of this, then?
Not a standard, but a great example of how, you know, remember, it's kind of interesting how America has changed in a fairly short period of time. If you remember 1976, Jimmy Carter went from 20 points ahead to 2 points ahead over Gerald Ford because he admitted having sexual fantasies to Playboy magazine. He had lust in his heart.
Had lust in his heart, yeah.
Right. So, in the 60s, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but Nelson Rockefeller was 3 times ran for president, never won because he was divorced. That was considered such a scandal. But by the time Ronald Reagan was elected in 80 as our first divorced president, nobody cared. So the country's grown up a lot in that way, and then now we saw with the sexual stuff with Clinton, people believed he was doing a good job. They didn't think it should affect, you know, most people figured by the grace of God, if I was in the same position, even in a courthouse, and asked such a question, and I'd be so embarrassed and humiliated, I would have lied too. So it really humanized him and made people feel sympathy for him. They liked the job he was doing as president. So the sexual stuff simply did not stick. And as a result of that, you're not going to see anybody attacking, for instance, McCain or Giuliani, who have had marital problems in the past.
And Giuliani, of course, it's alleged that he's got many other problems in things in his closet. Besides that, we don't know, because his campaign is probably going to come to an end today, the way it looks, anyway.
We'll find that out today. The numbers kind of look, I've seen conflicting numbers, but you could be right.
Yeah. What's the difference between doing this and working for the National Enquirer?
Here's the difference. The National Enquirer, there's not nearly as much at stake, because you're dealing with celebrities who basically thrive on this kind of publicity. With most celebrities, you know, actors and singers, etc., even bad publicity is good publicity. And, for instance, just give you an example, all the stuff with Britney Spears, every time she releases a record that's not doing well or a CD that's not doing well, she checks into some hospital for drugs. So with them, it's a pretty benign situation. Unfortunately, when we do it with our politicians, it's not good for our political system. It's not good. It doesn't give people faith in their political system. It's just an overall negative thing. But unfortunately, sometimes it's a necessary evil. People have the right to know certain things if they're going to make an educated vote. But on the other hand, it does cause a lot of cynicism in our country, and that's the difference, where that's much more dangerous or more harmful than something from the National Enquirer.
Did you ever have any guilt feelings about any of it that you were doing, that you knew it was going to hurt somebody, or did it ever bother you?
I've had situations where initially I did not have guilt, but later on did. I'll give a couple of brief examples. And one of the things you find out when you're an opposition researcher, when you're a political hitman, sometimes you find out you're working for the wrong side. We often have to research, like I said, our opponents as well as our person, and then you find out the guy you're working on behalf of is 10 times worse than the other guy. In my case, sometimes you find out years later you were working for the wrong side. I talk about in the book about how I was hired by the partner of Jack Abramoff to do some research on a business associate that they were having problems with. And I researched this guy, and he was a bad guy. I mean, he had indicted by the feds for all kinds of really bad stuff. He had 2 sets of families with 2 sets of children in each family. Really, really bad guy. And it wasn't until Abramoff got indicted 5 years later I found out that, at least in this situation between Abramoff and this bad guy was really the good guy, at least in this situation. In fact, he was assassinated in the mob style in the middle of while I was investigating him. And Abramoff ended up taking all the money from the company he bought from him, just looted the company into bankruptcy. And I didn't know till Abramoff got indicted, I realized, my God, all that time I was working for the bad guys. And it really gave me pause to wonder, how many other times have I had clients where I was working for the good guys, and in the end, I didn't really, you know, and how many other times have I been involved in situations where my actions caused bad things to happen, and I didn't know. And kind of like what I say in the book, even the smartest man doesn't know what he doesn't know. And just one last thing about negative, feeling negative. I put out some pretty negative 527 ad against John Kerry in 2004, and one against, they weren't called 527 in those days, they were just called independent expenditure ads in 2000 against Al Gore. The one with Gore, I kind of have a little bit of regret in more recently, because I think the attack was maybe... what happened was, in New York, Al Gore was campaigning with Bill Bradley trying to get the black vote, and he said some nice things about Al Sharpton. And in New York in those days, this is before Sharpton moderated himself like he is today,
mm-hmm.
back in those days he was a very divisive guy. He made statements like, our founding fathers are the scum of Europe, and he'll tell college students to kill cops, really bad stuff. And Gore kind of praised him in this debate, sucking up to the black vote. So I showed footage of Gore praising Sharpton, followed by saying we shouldn't be quick to dismiss what Sharpton has to say. And then the voiceover said, oh, really, Mr. Gore? Well, here's what Sharpton said. He said Adolf Hitler was a great man. And then actually got footage of Sharpton telling college students to kill cops, and Sharpton calling, you know, really saying really bad things. And in retrospect, it was kind of a stretch. I never really implied Al Gore believed in any of this racist stuff. He was just kind of defending a guy that said it. I did it at the time because I thought there was a double standard, because the Republican candidates were getting in trouble, namely George W. Bush, for doing the same thing with Bob Jones. And the Republicans had to really distance themselves from the wackos on their side, like Bob Jones, and had to repudiate them. And I thought it was wrong that you had, at the same time also, we had Joe Lieberman sucking up to Farrakhan. I didn't think that that was right. So I put that commercial out there trying to show that there was a double standard, but in retrospect, it probably was a little bit of a stretch and really wasn't fair to Al Gore.
Well, I think there's quite a bit of stretching goes on across party lines on those things. I discussed, when I was away this week, I discussed your book with somebody else that read it, and a D.C. insider, as a matter of fact. And we talked about the part that you just mentioned about Jack Abramoff, and I think the bad guy you're talking about that was off there was probably the guy in Miami that had the cruise, the gambling boat. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes, Gus Boulos. Yeah.
Yeah. How could you have worked for Jack Abramoff's group and been kind of a bag man for him and not know anything about Jack Abramoff?
In those days, you got to remember back in 01. People in D.C., all we knew about Jack Abramoff was that he was a guy with a lot of money and that he was a Republican and he helped Republicans and he was well-connected. We had no idea. I didn't even know, honestly, at that time, I didn't even know the guy was a registered lobbyist. We found that out later on. I just thought he was a PR guy. He had a PR firm with this other guy, Michael Scanlon, who I did some work for, who, nicest guy, you know, like I said in the book, just one of the nicest guys I ever met. I never met or dealt with Abramoff personally, but I knew he was the partner of Mr. Scanlon. And again, you know, it might be easy to think that now, but trust me, before that indictment came out, people knew that maybe he was a character, maybe he looked a little weird for Washington, looked like, I put in the book, he looked like a goon from an Edwin G. Robinson movie, but nobody knew the guy was a crook until 2005 when the indictments all came down, the federal indictments.
I do know the story about the Indian tribes putting them against one another did float around for quite a little while before.
Right.
Jack actually bragged about that around Washington. He wasn't
right.
Real good about keeping his mouth shut. So that one was well known, I think, back in 2004.
Right. He got in trouble for an email he wrote that said, "Yowza, we're going to get rich," or something crazy.
Yes,
like that.
Yes, he did. And once again, folks, if you just tuned in, we're talking to Stephen Marks. He's the author of a new book called Confessions of a Political Hitman. You will find it an interesting read, believe me. It's interesting, it's salacious, it's got a little bit of everything in it, it really does. And I found some I found a couple of contradictions that I'll get to in a moment that
sure.
I feel there were contradictions. But also I wanted to know about the Nation's magazine. You made some charges in it about the Nation's magazine.
You mean Nation magazine?
The Nation.
Yeah.
And it so happens that the person that's ahead of that magazine right now is a friend of mine.
Okay.
And I wondered, where did you get this that the magazine had flat-out supported communist efforts against America?
Not against America, but back when what happened was...
It says against America in the book.
Okay, okay. I was researching a candidate running for Congressman, Hamilton Fish, Jr., who was trying to succeed his father, who had the same name, up in Westchester County, and he had been, I guess, the editor of that magazine. So I went to the library in D.C., and I got back copies, and I found stuff, for instance, back in the 80s when they were flagrantly defending the communists in Nicaragua against our efforts when Reagan was president. They had love boat trips to Cuba. They supported the communist guerrillas in El Salvador. So, you know, these were all during the Cold War. By the time, by the time this guy ran, and I was looking at this stuff, the nation was no longer saying crazy stuff like that. But back, I was looking at back issues Hamilton Fish was still the editor, and they were very, very openly supporting Castro, supporting, like I said, the communists in El Salvador and in Nicaragua while we were still fighting the Cold War. And we did use that in that campaign again to defeat him.
His father was his father, as I recall, actually urged people not to vote for him, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And the family goes all the way back, like 100 years. Like, one of them was FDR's Secretary of the Treasury. I mean, the Fish family. And, yeah, exactly. His father, who had the same name, told people not to vote for him because the candidate in 94, the son, was trying to confuse people into thinking he was his father. But since his father was a Republican and he was a Democrat, people figured out who the candidate was. He was trounced by Congressman Sue Kelly, who just got defeated last year, by the way, in the whole wake of the Iraq War.
Okay, a couple of the contradictions in the book that I wanted to ask you about. Number one, and I won't go too far into it, but I know you're a fan of Rudy Giuliani.
Yes.
You feel that he was a great mayor in New York,
yes,
and all that. And you're an opposition researcher. A lot of people call it digging dirt, all that sort
yes.
of thing. And you're well aware of the fact that Rudy has a list of things behind his name that although he's never been convicted or charged or anything, you're aware of the surroundings of Rudy Giuliani, mm-hmm. aren't
of
you?
Of course. Of course.
And so knowing that and doing what you do,
mm-hmm.
How does that jibe with Rudy Giuliani's reputation and so forth around?
Well, the same way a lot of Democrats who really liked Bill Clinton and thought that he was doing an overall good job, when all the sexual stuff came out, plus a lot of the other scandals as well, his first term of his administration was scandal after scandal, thought, you know what, on balance, I'm going to maybe overlook some of these things because I'm looking at the big picture. So I'm looking at the big picture. I grew up in New York City and personally saw how one man single-handedly took it from the dump that it was. If you watch The French Connection or Death Wish or any of those films and see what the grittiness, the graffiti, what that city looked like, and I saw how this man took it to a city where when I go back there today, I expect to see Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant come out of a cab. It's unbelievable. And prior to that, of course, his job, the incredible job he did as a U.S. federal prosecutor, crippling the mafia. I mean, a real latter-day Elliot Ness, as well as prosecuting corrupt politicians and the Wall Street insider trader guys. I mean, this guy just, I believe, has the brains and the toughness to be a great leader. I just want to say one thing real quick. Had 9/11 happened under Rudy Giuliani's watch, if he was president, I guarantee you the next day the head of the FBI, head of the CIA, INS, FAA, and Motor Vehicles Bureau would have all been canned on the spot instead of what George W. Bush did, create a brand new bureaucracy and give the people who screwed up more power. If you read his book called Leadership, Giuliani, I'm not trying to plug him now, but I'm answering a question.
Yeah, but he would have given Bernie Kerik the job of running it then.
And you know,
right?
You know what? Yeah, you got a great point there, because Kerik did a great job as police commissioner, but the guy was a crook. And, you know, sometimes we have crooked people that do good jobs, and you're right about that. That's totally, that I could see both sides of that. But in his, you know, it's kind of like, remember when they asked Abraham Lincoln, how could you use Ulysses S. Grant? He's a drunk. And he said, yeah, he's a drunk, but he's my best general. So I guess I would look at the big picture, and if he helps, if he's overall doing great things for the city, what goes on in his personal life and these other little things, I can overlook that, just like people overlooked Clinton's indiscretion.
Yeah. The other contradiction I had in the book, first of all, and it occupies quite a little bit of this book, and I found it fascinating because
mm-hmm.
I do know a lot about this guy's sister, is the Pat Buchanan story.
Yes.
You mentioned that that you like Pat Buchanan, and you're not accusing him of doing anything wrong.
Correct.
That's right.
Totally honest, good guy.
And yet, he was a candidate with a campaign under him that was probably as dirty as any that's been run in my lifetime.
I would tend to agree with that, yes.
His sister, Bay, who was the treasurer of the United States for a couple of years in the
mm-hmm.
Reagan administration, I think.
Correct.
She ran Pat's campaign, and this woman knows how to make a buck off the general public, doesn't she?
She does. And the real problem that I thought was terrible was, you know, Pat, it went against everything Pat stands for, you know, standing up for the little guy against the corrupt, greedy, rich people. And here you had a campaign, $7-an-hour workers weren't being paid overtime as required by federal law while she was making six figures. And not just during the campaign years, but in between the three campaigns, and I talked about this in the book, they took the remaining funds, and you can't pocket the money legally, but you can't give it to charity. So they created their own charity called the American Cause, where she was made president or and vice president or whatever, and where she collected six-figure salaries in between campaigns as well. So that, to me, was you know, pretty despicable.
You didn't exactly have a great personal relationship with her. You did work for her for a while, didn't you?
Very briefly, yes. The original campaign manager who hired me, a guy named his name was Guy Rogers. I really, really liked the guy. He was the national field director for the Christian Coalition. Prior to that, he had a great reputation. We got along great. I was only working there 2-3 weeks when he quit, and then I had to deal. I had to report not to him, but directly to Bay, and we did not get along personally. You're right. And
as I recall, she humiliated you and told you that. If I can remember right, that you ought to pay attention to this guy that she hired that had no experience, and you could learn a lot from him.
Right. She also, I have to admit, she got the better of me on a debate we had on CNN once. Being, you know, it's my first time on television, and she had a lot of experience. But yeah, we did not get along personally.
I was going to say, rumor has it. I know a lot of people that know her. And I don't know anybody that gets along with her. So she's a tough one. She is,
and it's funny because she has a lot of good qualities, like her brother Pat, but she just doesn't. Let's just say she doesn't have, I believe, his people skills, or she doesn't. You know, Pat's just your typical, real friendly Irish guy that just kind of gets along with everybody, and she, to my opinion, was not.
In addition
to all the other. Unethical and illegal things were going on in that campaign. Just one of them I'll mention, which I talk about in the book too. And I made a complaint with the FEC about all this stuff. One of the things they were doing was they were laundering campaign contributions to get matching funds, federal matching funds that they did not really qualify for. Just in a nutshell, what they would do is certain contributions are matchable if they're on check or a money order, and if they're, I think, at least $200. So Buchanan would get a lot of contributions from poor people for like $1, $5, $10. Sometimes cash would come in the envelopes. So they would just take the money from different contributors, make it into a $400 check, give it to a staffer, and tell the staffer, can you write us a campaign of $400 check? Well, to the staffer, it looks like an even deal, but here's where it's not. That check to the campaign now becomes matchable, and which means federal government taxpayer dollars go into that campaign. And I offered to the FEC proof of that, including witnesses that admitted doing it. And the FEC, as they always do, you know, they are one of the most toothless jokes of federal bureaucracy. Their ruling after this, like, three-year-long investigation into my charges was, yeah, these charges are true, but you know what? We don't have the time nor resources to really get into this. And they basically let Babe Buchanan and the rest of them skate.
And she continued to milk not only her campaign, but another one she worked for years afterward. Am I correct?
She was with Buchanan's foundation, the American Cause. For years afterwards. And I think I could be mistaken, but I think this year she was running Tom Tancredo's campaign. I could be mistaken.
And I think now she's with. I don't know. I think she's with Romney right now. I'm not exactly sure.
I'm not sure either.
As you well know, there's so many of them in Washington. You lose track of it.
If Romney did hire her, it's because she has the list. And what I mean by the list is literally it's like one of the crown jewels of Republican politics. It's the donor list of every single person that gave money to Pat Buchanan. This might sound crazy, but it's true. In 1996, there were more individual contributors to Buchanan than either Clinton or Dole. It's just that the average contributor was $20, whereas the average Dole or Clinton contributor was $1,000. So, but still, that's a mighty impressive list, and those are, you know, that there's a lot of, you know, a lot of money can be raised through that list.
People don't have any idea of all this that goes on. I mean, the general public doesn't have a good idea of what goes on inside Washington, do they?
No. Well, that was one of the things hopefully this book would point out, not to make people cynical, but just help them understand when they see all the negative stuff on TV now. It'll help put it into context and help them maybe learn how to sift, when they see all the negative attacks, sift the legitimate ones from the ones that are BS. And I just want to make one last point. We opposition researchers, as a general rule, we give the campaigns correct, accurate information. Now, they might want to skew it or distort it in a commercial, and unfortunately, we have nothing to do with that. And it is despicable practice. I've had clients put out commercials and afterwards tell me to fact-check them after they put them out. So this does happen a lot, but as a general rule, I don't know of any opposition researcher that ever gave the campaign misleading or false information.
Just give them the right stuff, and then
they'll figure out a way to spin it.
They'll spin it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Stephen, I want to thank you so much. We've got top of the hour coming up in news. I could probably talk to you for 2 hours about this book, and I want to reserve the right to have you back on again sometime
soon.
I really
appreciate that, and that's politicalhitman.com for anybody who's interested in learning about me or the book. There's also a link there to Amazon, or they can go directly to Amazon.com.
And it's generally available just about everywhere right now. So.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Stephen Marks, author of Confessions of a Political Hitman. It is a fabulous read, folks. You'll love
appreciate
it. I know you will.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Stephen. For the nice words.
Thank you. It is an interesting book. It's one of those ones I couldn't put down. So many times you get a book about politics nowadays, and I don't know. There's just something about this one that the more I read, they go, oh, my God, oh, no. And I'm just reading through it, it's a darn good book. For example, Chapter 16 is Sex, Lies, and Republican Hypocrisy, The Downfall of the GOP. Now, that's a pretty doggone interesting chapter right there. That's a big chapter. Cynical Politics at its Worst in Louisiana. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. This guy's been on the inside. He knows. He's got a lot to say about Tom DeLay and Ronnie Earle. He's got to say about his. He got something to say about Mark Foley and his crimes and about himself as well. He doesn't. Stephen doesn't paint himself as any angel in this book. He's been out and about and had his share of fun too. But it covers Clinton. It covers Jesse Helms. Very, very interesting book. I just know that most of you would really like this book. And I, as you know, we don't really hawk books on this show, but when I find something I think is this interesting, I'm just sure you'll enjoy it, and I'm glad to pass it on to you. Mostly, not for the author's benefit, but for yours. I think you'll really enjoy the insight that comes with this book, and you'll learn something from it, believe me. Again, that's Confessions of a Political Hitman by Stephen Marks. Oh, my. That half hour went by really fast. We're coming up to the top of the hour and the news. We've got Dr. Heidi Hartman coming up in the second hour from the Institute for Women's Policy Research. We're going to talk about this stimulus package that they're trying to put together right now and send out all these little rebate checks to everybody. I don't know how you feel about it. I'm not so crazy about it. I'll have to tell you about the conversation I overheard in Washington from some store clerks about it. Maybe I already did. I don't know. Anyway, we'll be back after the news. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network.
A commonly prescribed sleeping drug, Zolpidem, which deceased film actor Heath Ledger admitted taking, has been linked to 6 deaths in the UK. The grandson of Indian spiritual leader Mahatma Gandhi resigned as president of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence after writing an online essay calling Jews and Israel the biggest players in a global culture of violence. In his resignation letter, Gandhi wrote he wanted to generate a healthy discussion on the proliferation of violence. New York City is suing executives of Countrywide Financial, one of the biggest U.S. mortgage lenders, who cashed out to the tune of almost $700 million while borrowers lost homes and the value of investors' shares fell sharply. A new report by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction has found widespread rebuilding failures by Parsons Corporation, the American construction giant. The new report examined 200 Parsons construction projects contained in 11 major job orders, costing the U.S. taxpayer $365 million. The new report finds that 8 job orders were terminated by the U.S. before they were completed for weak contract oversight, unrealistic schedules, a failure to report problems in a timely fashion, and poor supervision. Previous reports on Parsons gave numerous examples of incomplete or shoddily built healthcare clinics and border forts, as well as disastrous sewage and plumbing problems at the Baghdad Police Academy.
Top of the hour news brought to you by INN World Report.
The New York Times reports that Mikhail Gorbachev has called for major reform to Russia's electoral system. The former Soviet leader said Sunday, "Something is wrong with our elections and our electoral system needs a major adjustment." Gorbachev's remarks, which were ignored by Russian television news, followed the Russian government's rejection of the only serious opposition candidate in the March 2nd presidential election, as President Vladimir Putin prepares to pass power to a chosen successor. The opposition candidate, former Prime Minister Mikhail Kazyanov, was denied a place on the ballot by the Central Election Commission, which said 13% of the 2 million signatures submitted with his registration documents were invalid. Kazyanov says the signatures are valid and that the Kremlin ordered the commission to block his candidacy to ensure the election of Putin's candidate, Dmitry Medvedev.
In 1 minute.
Life, you hear me? Give my creation life.
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
Your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here on the Guy James Show today, coming to you from beautiful Southwest Florida on the World Wide Web, all across the country and all around the world. And thank you for joining us today. So good to have you along with us. If you care to join the show, you can give us a call at 866-546-5254. Love to have you. Coming up at 4:15, we've got Dr. Heidi Hartman of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. We're going to talk about this compromise stimulus package between the House and the White House. It leaves a lot to be desired, and we'll be talking about that. I know a lot of you watched the State of the Union speech last night. I did. I stayed awake. I yawned a lot, but I watched it. Circus that it is, and that's exactly what, you know. I watched that thing, and while I have an understanding of party loyalty, and you know I do, I'm a Democrat.
I really don't understand taking your partisan politics to the point where the nation will be drastically damaged by remaining loyal to one's party and electing somebody who you know in advance would most likely be a failure as our president. And we've done that. Not me. This last election of Junior Bush is confounding to me. And if any Republican is to be completely honest, surely they realize that electing Romney or McCain or Giuliani or Huckleberry would be nothing more than four more years of the Bush agenda. You have to know that. And the Republican candidates have walked the Bush walk, and now they're talking the Bush talk. Remember, they all said they thought the war was a great idea. And it's very apparent that they're not willing to change the direction of the country, but rather continue on with the just ruinous policies of this Bush administration. And they are ruinous. Let's face it, there wouldn't be a dime's worth of difference between any one of the Republican candidates and Junior Bush. You know there wouldn't. We need a new State of the Union. And without question, the state of our union has vastly deteriorated during Junior Bush's administration with the willing complicity of the Republicans in Congress and very weak, and I want to add that, very weak leadership from the Democrats, Pelosi and Reid. Very weak. And you only have to look at the fiscal condition of the country right now. Bush took over government with record surpluses. They've turned them into huge deficits and massive debt. Debts that's mostly owed to the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Middle Easterners. And thanks to Bush's fiscal policies, we now have a monumental, the numbers are staggering, $10 trillion worth of debt. Get your calculator out and figure that one out for every man, woman, and child. $10 trillion. But that doesn't seem to matter to him or his people at all. And despite the massive debt, he's pushing more and more and more for the same tax cuts that favor the wealthy and are deficit financed. There's nothing about the so-called stimulus package that'll foster new growth in our economy. Nothing. His plan, and everybody better realize this, is nothing more than a stall tactic to ward off a massive economic recession and to keep it at bay as long as possible so that he can blame the new Democratic president, whoever it may be, and save his own already pitiful legacy. That's what this is all about. It's the same thing with the war. We all need to appeal to our fellow Americans and ask them to think of the country first and the party later right now. 75% of Americans think America is on the wrong track. The wrong track, according to the latest New York Times poll. And Bush gave his final State of the Union, thank God, his final State of the Union message last night. And we can only hope that it's going to be the last one from a Republican for a long, long time. All of their candidates want to keep the war going, and all of them are in favor of the same tax cuts for the rich and screw the rest of the nation policies that Junior Bush has established during his long, long, long 7 years in office. And I think all across this nation, the Democrats have finally awoken. The numbers of primary voters have increased dramatically since the last time we had them. South Carolina was up by 82%. And taking a look at the other side of that, when the Republican participation actually fell. And Democrats are more trusted to handle the economy, health care, and energy policies by double digits, according to the latest Wall Street Journal poll. Now, I've talked to many, many Republicans in the past couple of years who are very, very dissatisfied with this Bush administration. And we can only hope these people and their fellow Republicans all across the country see the light and understand that any of the current crop, any of them, doesn't make any difference which one, any one of this current crop of Republicans being elected to the Oval Office would be an unmitigated disaster for the nation. I swear to God, I don't know how anybody can consider electing one of these men to the presidency. I do not understand. Knowing, knowing damn well that any one of them, Giuliani, Huckleberry, Romney, and McCain, all four of them will continue the Bush policies. You know they will. They've all talked about how much they love the tax cuts. So why on earth would anybody elect any one of those men? Why? It's a mystery to me. Just an absolute mystery to me. You know, as I mentioned earlier in the program today, they always accuse the Democrats of being tax and spend liberals. And the Republicans right now, they're doing let's don't tax and spend anyway. I'm fascinated by that. I really am. Don't know how that could happen. We're going to pause for a quick break. We'll be right back.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Tune in to Foxed Up this Thursday midnight Eastern, where we'll take a look at singer Sheryl Crow. Find out about her experience working for Michael Jackson.
Michael is, he's not like every other performer, and I think everyone has to sign a contract when they work with him, not to write a book, you know, about what goes on behind the scenes or whatever.
She'll also talk about her problems with Walmart. So be there this Thursday midnight Eastern on Foxed Up, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn. This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Love is a secret everyone knows. Love is a charm that brings when the wind blows. To keep yourself honest so it can grow. Cause when you've lost it, your heart turns cold. Isn't it so? I remember the first girl that I really loved. However it hurt her, she loved me enough. I wanted to wander, she knew I would go. She said I didn't know when I'd be alone. Wasn't it so? Thankfully I was forced there where now very unfettered it was. Living a suddenly just like that, going God knows where I was. Chasing a rainbow, she understood. She was a prophet. She told me I should follow my heart like I've been told. Seek out your vision before you get old. Isn't it so? Now many years later, finally see how much she did love me. She set me free. Her last few dollars put gas in my car. Said promise to ride me wherever you are. From out on the highway, I think I rode quite. I always remember simple and light. Love is a secret everyone knows. Try too hard to hide it, it never will show. Isn't it so?
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. And as promised, I have on the line right now Dr. Heidi Hardman. She is the president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Heidi, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
I felt it important that we have you on today to talk about this stimulus package that our government is coming up with, going to be the end-all, be-all of our economic woes in this country for everybody. That's what they're
making. That'd be great if it were.
Well, it's a magic pill, yes. You and your organization, first of all, tell us about the Institute for Women's Policy Research. What do you do? What's your mission?
Sure, I'd love to. We're about 20 years old, and our mission is basically to do social science research around policy issues that are of great importance to women, and to get that information out to the public, out to activists and advocates, out to policymakers in state houses or in Congress, and, you know, with the hope that it will illuminate those policy issues and, you know, help advance the good ones and kill the bad ones.
And you're one of the founders of the organization, am I right?
Yes, that's correct. And I'm an economist by training in labor economics, went to Yale University. And, you know, there's a lot of fun, really, to be looking at current policy issues. We do a lot of work, for example, on the issue of paid sick days. We do a lot of work on child care. We do a lot of work on the wage gap, the, you know, gender gap in pay, unemployment insurance, and employment and unemployment in general. So we're always, you know, taking a look at the business cycle and what's going on.
Well, tell me, as far as this stimulus package is concerned, where it's concerned, do you see this as the typical Washington politician inside the Beltway ploy to buy some votes, or do you see this as having some merit to actually help this recession that we seem to be in?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, I thought it was a rather surprising move, actually, on the part of our Democratic leadership in the House to go to the White House first and compromise first instead of, you know, putting out their own plan, because you would think it would be the one opportunity that they would have to get something they would want, because of the need for Republicans to get reelected too. They have a need to get reelected just as much as the Democrats do. You would think it would have been hard for President Bush to veto any stimulus package that had been agreed to in the House by his, you know, Republican minority in the House. So I'm a little surprised that they went and did the negotiation and the compromise first. Now, this way, it's being left up to the Democrats in the Senate and some Republicans to try to get some better things in that stimulus package, because it doesn't look like it's, you know, really going to do everything we want.
Well, if it's typical Washington politics, and if it's a typical bill, you know everybody's going to try and load it up with pork. And I know Mr. Bush mentioned that in his State of the Union speech last night. What are the chances of it getting through without being loaded up with a bunch of other things?
Well, I mean, there's good pork and bad pork, you know. Most of us aren't against good pork, are we? I mean, you know, we look at the government for things that we need. And the idea of the economic stimulus is that the economy is either in recession already or approaching recession. What can the government do to try to keep it from being as bad as possible? Maybe if it isn't already in recession, keep it from happening. We look to the government to do that. I mean, that's a perfect, goodly, you know, very good role for government. For example, the Federal Reserve, they jumped in by lowering the discount rate. That helps. That increases the availability of money. The idea behind the stimulus, however, is that is the idea that we need to stimulate aggregate demand. The Federal Reserve can make all the money they want available. If there's nobody that can put that money to productive use, because investors don't think, you know, they think it's a downturn, they don't think there's a lot they can do with it, they won't do it. And so you need to stimulate aggregate demand, and you do that by giving the money to the people who will spend it, will spend all of it, and will spend it quickly. And that's why this is not the best stimulus package. The stimulus package that the House and the White House agreed to is a tax rebate. It's $300 per person for lower-income people, $500 per person for upper-income people, up to a cap. And they're crowing about the fact, well, we capped it. We didn't give it to the very, very highest income. Yeah, great, but you're giving less to the people at the bottom. And you're not doing the most immediate things that the economists noted should be done, like extending unemployment insurance benefits, like food stamps, like energy assistance for people who need help heating their homes. You could crank those things out into the economy very quickly. The reason to give the lowest income people the money is that they are going to stimulate the aggregate demand the most for the dollar spent from the government. So I don't think it's a bad idea at all if the Senate can get food stamps, unemployment insurance, perhaps aid to the states added to that stimulus package. You know, pork, when used pejoratively, usually refers to, you know, congresswoman or congressman's pet project in his or home district.
A sewing museum on the back street of his own town or something. That's, you know.
Well, now we don't want to knock sewing.
No.
So, you know, I don't think Bush's, I think Bush's call for not loading it up is, you know, disingenuous. I mean, he wants his version because he wants to say he got another tax cut for the American people. Basically, the reason it's a tax cut is that that's what Bush likes. He wants to be able to say that his legacy is tax cuts. And, I think what we really want is a stimulus package that works. And even the experts in the Congressional Budget Office and elsewhere are saying tax cuts, A, are not, even if you pass them tomorrow, are not going to get in people's, you know, mailboxes until May, June, July, whereas some of these other things, unemployment insurance benefits, food stamps, we could get to the people who need them sooner. So I think it's, you know, kind of a crippled stimulus package. And then you could argue is economic stimulus, you know, all that we need right now. I mean, that's a short-term fix for a short-term problem.
How soon do you think they would be able to implement this? If you're talking about an energy and the food stamps and so forth, would you be able to get that done quicker?
Well, definitely with unemployment insurance, you could get it done, you know, almost right away because you've already got everything in place. You have an office and a system where people go to get their benefits. If their benefits would be ending after 26 weeks, and we have 250,000 more people around the country who have hit that 26-week limit than we had 1 year ago. So those 250,000 people, or the next 250,000 people, the ones that would come up and be about to lose it, they can go down there and get the 27th week, the 28th week, the 29th week. So for them, it's instantaneous. The ones who were just about to go off, they just get it right away. The other people who haven't been coming down to the office to collect, you know, they have to get themselves to go back. But, you know, for a certain segment of it, yes, food stamps are already being handed out monthly, so you can pretty easily increase the amount of them, which was the proposal, I think, increase the amount of them 10% or something like that. You can do that, you know, pretty easily because you already have systems in place. Same thing with fuel assistance. You've already got a system in place for that. You can expand it readily. The tax cut, you have an IRS system, but what IRS was saying is that they're going to be completely busy with the, you know, annual income tax return and those refunds, and they're not going to be able to start on these until May.
Is there an inflationary aspect to all this?
Well, yes, but when you're facing unemployment and slow growth, inflation is, you know, not usually recedes. You know, you notice this with the Federal Reserve Bank. All fall long, they're saying, oh, no, our biggest problem is inflation, blah, blah, blah. Then all of a sudden, well, wait a minute, we're not going to worry about inflation. We're going to lower the discount rate, encourage, you know, make it easier for the banks to borrow money from each other, blah, 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 reduce the price of credit. Now they're no longer worried about inflation because they're much more worried about, you know, using the full productive capacity of the economy. What a recession means is that we're not using the full productive capacity that we have. We have idle productive capacity sitting out there, things that aren't being used, factories that aren't producing, business services offices that don't have clients anymore, construction firms that have nothing to build, and they lay people off. So that tends to bring prices down, and that's why, because that has a deflationary pressure, that's why we worry less about inflation, you know, during a recessionary period or possibly recessionary period. And so that concern about inflation sort of recedes into the background. And then we worry about other things like, oh, well, gee, we better get these productive assets productive again. We better put people back to work. You know, we better figure out a way to make sure people have jobs. And
sure.
We'll worry about that more.
Well, you are a president of the Institute of Women's Policy Research. Tell me why, not why necessarily, that's the wrong word, How this affects women, and why we've got many women who are ahead of a household, a single mother with families. That this is this whole business that we're going through right now is tougher on them than anybody else, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, basically, any family with just one adult in it is at a disadvantage. If that one adult loses a job, there's no other adult to try to go out and get a job. So, you know, very often if you have a married couple, even if you had the old-fashioned kind of married couple, which we don't have very many of anymore, let's say the man is working and the wife is not, if he loses his job and has trouble finding a job, she might go out and find a job. You know, like let's say he loses a job in construction, she might go out and find a job in retail or something. So if you're a single parent, male or female, with no other adult in the house, you can't do that. For women, it's especially more difficult because their wages are low to begin with. They're, you know, even if they work full-time year-round, they're only earning about 75% of what the typical male who works full-time year-round earns. So they're starting out with a lower pay, which means they have probably less savings, less of a cushion saved up. If they do get unemployment insurance benefits because they lose a job, their benefits will be lower because, you know, the more your pay was, the higher the benefits. And they have already a lower standard of living because they're trying to support children on a lower salary. So they're very much disadvantaged. It's also very difficult to find jobs with health insurance that provide any health insurance for your children. Yes, oh sure, it's available. We have the group plan. It's available if you want to pay for it. But the amount, the extent to which employers are paying for dependent children's premiums is going down. So one of the things that can easily happen in a recession, even if you are one of the ones who doesn't lose a job, is you can find all of these costs going up. Your employer is going to be looking for ways to cut costs, so your hours of work might fall. You might not get that raise. They might announce that copays on your health insurance policy are going up. Maybe the share they're going to pay of your kids' premiums is going down. Your share is going to go up. So even for those who don't lose jobs, all of these belt-tightening measures that employers typically take in a recession, you know, are really going to affect women disproportionately. I think it was maybe today that the Center for Economic and Policy Research, they came out with a study of what the next recession would be like if it was kind of an average of the last four. And I think they came up with a fall in health insurance coverage of 1.4 percentage points, or another 4.2 million people without health insurance. So things like that. You might still have your job, but you might lose your health insurance.
Well, that's very disconcerting. I just returned from Washington, having attended the Health Action 2008, the Families USA conference about...
Yes, right, just a couple of days ago.
Yes, and, you know, we can ill afford to have fewer people covered, and it's bad enough. You know, we tossed around something in a roundtable we were talking about concerning that. A lot of people, and you just mentioned... dependents, health care, maybe a cut if you're with your employer and so forth. People don't understand so many times how these things just spread. For example, you've got a kid in school and you've got great health insurance. You've got insurance. Your husband's got insurance. There are four or five kids in the class who don't have any insurance. They come to school with the flu. Your kid gets it, you get sick, you miss work, your husband misses work. I mean, it just all that. People fail to recognize the fact that this is not just the problem of the lone person who doesn't have the insurance. It just travels on and on and on, and, you know, it's a cost to all of us in the end.
Exactly, and this is one of the sort of surprising things about the United States. This was a pretty interesting article in the New Yorker a few years ago, and it talked about how historically people in the United States were always healthy compared to Europeans, taller, and this was noticed during World War I. All of a sudden, all these tall people came over from the United States into the European theater of operations, and now we're no longer the tallest people, and this is... even discounting for immigration, like sort of standardize the population as if we hadn't had immigration growth from, say, Mexico and Asia, take that away, we still are not we've lost in height. And the hypothesis of this article was, well, height, you know, is just a pretty good overall measure for nutrition, health, And they haven't been able to find one segment of American society that is as tall, on average, as I think it's the Netherlands that has the tallest people now.
Yes.
And so even people who go to country clubs, people who go to elite Ivy League colleges, and I think this, you know, very much echoes your point that the health of the population, it just rubs off on everybody. Fast food, everybody's eating fast food. You know, everything that happens in a country tends to affect everybody. And, you know, it's just kind of sad when we had such natural advantage, you know, such great farmland, such good food, that we had such tall people back at the beginning of the last century.
Yes.
Relative to the rest of the world, but we don't anymore.
Well, if we're going to be selfish and just want ourselves covered and not worry about anybody else with health coverage, they should, I guess my point was, they should carry on the selfishness and worry about somebody else not having it and giving it to you, the flu. So, if they want to be selfish in that way, they ought to carry it on through the whole circle there. I spoke to Kent Conrad about the stimulus package, and he's hot and cold on it. Well, not hot. I don't want to say hot at all. what do you recommend is the number one thing that really needs to be put in it that is not in it right now?
Well, I guess speaking as an expert on women's situation, I would say food stamps. I mean, food stamps is a means-tested program. You only get them if you're low income. And people spend their food stamps, and the fact that they'll have more money to spend on food will enable them to spend a little more money on other things. And the people, you know, the lower you are in the income scale, the more likely you are to spend everything that you get. And that's an important part of the stimulus. You don't want people to get the money who are just going to put it in their bank account. That's not going to help. And the last tax rebate they did, about 85% or 80 to 85% of it was spent. But if you went with food stamps, you'd probably get much closer to 100% of it spent. And it would be, because it's helping the most down-and-out families, it would help women disproportionately, no question about it. Next, most important, I would say the unemployment insurance, because, again, unemployment insurance will definitely go to people who are likely to spend the money, because when you get unemployment insurance, it's only replacing some of your lost wages anyway. You know, maybe about two-thirds of your lost wages are replaced. So even if you were saving a little bit when you had a job, you're definitely likely to spend all of that unemployment insurance money that you get. So from a stimulus point of view, that's also very good. But, of course, you know, unemployment will go up and down the income scale. Some high-level people get laid off. Some low-level people get laid off. So it's not as good for helping the very bottom, but it's very, very important. Long-term unemployed do tend to be lower income and less skilled.
How likely do you think we are to get help in the stimulus package with the food stamps and the extended unemployment insurance?
I think it's really hard to say. I mean, very hard to know how hard the Senate is going to fight and how much support can be drummed up in the House. I mean, this was a compromise crafted by the leadership of the House on both sides of the aisle, and it's not, if the Senate is successful, then it has to go back to conference. You know, it's kind of a long, drawn-out process. I would have to say we haven't been very this side of things, the pro-poor people side or the progressive taxation side hasn't been very lucky in the Congress in terms of being able to override the president's veto if he were to choose to veto it. So there's quite a few steps involved.
You're very kind using the word luck. we haven't been aggressive at all. I must tell you that my listeners, mostly progressive, liberal, democratic activists, have been very disappointed in this Congress in many, many ways, and a little more aggression might help. I don't know politically what the answer is, but it seems that...
there's a lot of... if they're activists, there's a lot of activism out there. You know, every day on my email, I'm getting calls to protest this and protest that. And I think that according to, I think it was MoveOn.org that claimed that all of their pressure kept that, wiretapping thing from being voted on yesterday or from passing. So sometimes the activism works. And right now, people are, deluging the Congress with, we want unemployment insurance, we want food stamps, we want Medicaid, I mean, a big worry is that state budgets will fall because of the recession and because a lot of their income is based on property taxes, local government income, especially based on property taxes, real estate prices, property taxes are going to go down, revenues will go down, state and local government won't have the money, they will cut back on Medicaid. That will hurt the poor. So there's a lot of sentiment among your listeners, I'm sure, for aid to state and local governments so they won't have to cut back these essential services. But so there's an awful lot of activism on our side. I think the activists are being pretty aggressive, but we don't seem able, speaking as an activist for a moment, we don't seem able to get them to really pay attention to us. And, you know, that suggests a electoral strategy. If you can't get the people in office to do what you want, you have to throw them out of office.
Well, that, I can think of quite a few instances that might be the answer to our prayers. And we're working on that as well. Dr. Hartman, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. Your website for your organization is IWPR.org, right?
.org, right. And you'll find a lot of great stuff there on women and unemployment insurance, Social Security, poverty, the wage gap, all kinds of issues, and especially paid sick days. You were talking about the idea of communicating illnesses to each other, and you talked about, you know, the mom or dad not being able to go to work. Well, half of Americans wouldn't get any sick pay for that day that they're out off the job, so that's been one of our big issues the last few years.
I'm surprised it's as much as half.
It is. It is as much as half. I know. It's unbelievable. I didn't believe it, but that's data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. If you look at private sector workers, including state and local government, you just omit the federal government, civilian and military, you get like something like 49.X% right now that do not have a single paid sick day, not eligible for a single paid sick day.
Well, something that's going by the wayside in many, many sectors. Dr. Hartman, thank you so much for being on the program today. We appreciate it so very much. And again, everybody, that website is IWPR.org. Visit it. It is a great website. A lot of great information on there. Dr. Hartman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Interesting lady, and what she doesn't know about problems for women in all those aspects she talked about probably isn't worth knowing. Highly educated, very articulate, and also has been around the block in Washington, D.C., and knows the process well. And what she said toward the end of the interview there wasn't very comforting, was it? Perhaps we activists can't get anything done with our politicians, and it's time to turn some of them out. Well, I guess we all know that. Not happy with many of the politicians. The status quo just seems to be the way to go with so many of them. And we saw that last night once again. that State of the Union, I must say, it sickened me just a little bit. Always does every time I see Ed Bush talking about his tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. I wonder that given a free hand and no objections from the Democrats, just given a free hand, how much would they lower their own taxes for the fat cats? How low would they take them? Do you think they'd get them down to nothing? Do you think they'd be able to rationalize somehow that the poor people in the middle class should pay all the taxes? And that, I can think of a rationalization like that from the right-wingers. Well, we shouldn't have to pay taxes because, after all, we're the folks who stimulate the economy. We have all the money. We provide all the jobs. We have all the money in Wall Street, and therefore, we should not be taxed. Those of you who are making, you know, working for us should pay the taxes because we're the one that provide everything. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any jobs. You know, I can see them saying that. I wonder how low they would make their taxes if they had a chance, a free hand, to lower them as much as they possibly wanted to. I'd love to know the answer to that. I don't know how many of you saw that ludicrous video that was on Fox the other night. I think it was Saturday night. Was it Sunday night? Somebody sent it to me. I saw this video of a program Fox had, I think it was Saturday night, about the Junior Bush presidency. And I suppose it was meant to be a warm-up for last night's glorious State of the Union speech. Oh, my God, is there anybody worse at giving a speech than Junior Bush? Is there anybody? And, of course, the Fox piece was complimentary to Bush, you know it would be. The official Bush Giuliani network, Fox. Wonder how that's working for him, the Giuliani thing. And since it was complimentary to Bush, I expected nothing less from the official mouthpiece of the Republican Party. And they would like for us to think it was their opinion expressed in the program, but I'd rather think of it as exactly what it was, and that is political propaganda of the highest order. That's what this whole thing was about. Now you can have as many opinions as you like, but when you start messing with incontrovertible facts, that's when I have to object. And in this piece, Fox said, and I just start roaring over this, Fox said that Junior Bush reminded them of another important Republican, Abe Lincoln. Now, I've heard Bush being compared to Churchill a couple of times in the past few years, not lately. But this was the first time they made him the equal of honest Abe Lincoln. And Fox said in the piece, and let me quote him, that both men presided over unpopular wars, and Lincoln left office a hated president, end quote. Hated. Abraham Lincoln. Now, I will agree that Abe Lincoln was probably, when he left office, was probably hated by Johnny Reb. He was probably hated by any number of people that fought for the Confederacy, and maybe even a few Northerners as well. Maybe Jefferson Davis hated him. I don't know. Never heard Jefferson say so. But did I hear this right? Abe Lincoln left office hated. That's what I heard him say on this Fox piece. Well, all of a sudden, you know, you watch something like that, and I get this tremendous doubt creeping into my head. And I got to thinking, guy, is all that you've ever learned about Lincoln been false? I mean, I just saw this on Fox, and he said he left office. He was hated. I mean, was my recollection of the whole Lincoln history distorted somehow? I didn't think so, but, you know. Now, I knew he left office dead, even if Fox didn't, but did I have the rest of it wrong? So, you know, I started going back and doing a little research to see if my memory was completely wrong, and much to my comfort, I found that Lincoln was indeed assassinated a month into his second term. And not only that, but he'd won that election by a landslide. And this man that Fox said was hated when he left office, millions of people turned out to watch his funeral train take him back home to Springfield, Illinois. I can't decide whether these people are just sick, stupid, or both. Lincoln compared to Bush. And that wouldn't be so bad. You think, well, it's just propaganda. And you know it was not the truth, and I know it's not the truth, because I know my listeners are a cut above the average. But I have to wonder, when I hear things like this, how many young Republican fathers since Saturday night have told their kids that Junior Bush is just like Lincoln? I wonder how many young Republicans hear that and believe it. I wonder how many impressionable people saw that piece and say, man, it's George Bush, he's just like Abe Lincoln. I wonder how many of them don't know their history very well and say, you know that Abe Lincoln, he wasn't very popular when he left office. I wonder. That's what propaganda is, you know. You take fiction, or the big lie, and you turn it into fact by word of mouth. And you repeat it often. And that's how it works. And that's what Fox News is. A propaganda tool. Propaganda megaphone for the Republican Party. The right-wing conservatives They've adopted each other. Fox and right-wingers. These are some sick puppies, folks. These are some sick puppies that would put something like that on the air as truth. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Gonna pause for a break. We'll be right back.
Sun up by giving him a fresh air full of a wind cup, and I won't be found in the shadows hiding sorrow. I can wait for fate to bring to me any part of my tomorrow. It's all so peaceful here. No one bending over my shoulder. Nobody breathing in my ear. Oh, it's all so peaceful here. In the evening shadows are calling me, and the dew settles my mind, and I think of friends in the yesterday when my plans were giggled in rhyme. I had a son while on the run, his love brought a tear to my eye. Maybe someday he might say that I'm a pretty nice guy. Oh,
866-546-5254 if you'd like to join the program. 866-546-5254. Was I the only one that sat and listened to that State of the Union speech last night? Did I do that for nothing? Nobody wants to talk about it today? I mean, it is hard to talk about. It totally befuddles me as to why Democrats would clap for that guy when he enters the room. I know. I've been around Washington a lot of times, and you know you've got this genteel attitude they're supposed to have toward one another. But spare me, please. I've heard the respect for the office line, but respect for Junior Bush. You know, give me a break. And what did you think of the picture of Obama and McCaskill and Kennedy all just happened to sit together right there? That was planned out real nice, didn't you think? And then I heard Bush say last night that during the surge we killed thousands of Al-Qaeda leaders in Iraq. They've got thousands of Al-Qaeda leaders in Iraq? Thousands of them. Well, not anymore. Killed them all. And I love to watch him giving a speech in one respect. You can tell that he's like a little kid doing his lines in a class play up on, you know, he gets started and he goes faster and faster. He wants to get it over with. Once you get going, you know, start to speed up, and then he starts that stupid grinning of his. I that just sets me off. And once again, he did mention that our medical decisions should be made in the doctor's office. And aside from the fact that of the pro-choice consequences there, many of the medical decisions are not made in the doctor's office. Even if you go in for this malady or another one, the insurance companies are making the decisions. He didn't mention that, did he? And that'll only increase under his so-called plan. Of course, he gave us that old line, Americans have to balance their own budgets. Why doesn't the government have to do the same? Has he submitted a balanced budget? Has he? And, of course, when he started mentioning making the tax cuts for the rich permanent, the Republican legislators all stood up and cheered and hooted and hollered while the Democrats stayed sitting. You know, the average Joe Republicans thinks this is a good idea. You think he'll share those tax cuts with the average Joe Republican? I don't think so. But evidently the average Joe Republican is convinced that they will somehow share in those. And then he used this line, show the world the power and resilience of the American government, please. And I mentioned about the surge. They've been talking about the surge lately. You know, we had more soldiers killed today. I think five more in Mosul. Bush's assertion is, you know, he said we launched a surge of American forces into Iraq. We gave our troops a new mission. Work with the Iraqi forces to protect the Iraqi people. Pursue the enemy in these strongholds and deny the terrorists sanctuary anywhere in the country. Well, here's the fact. That's what Bush says. And here's the fact. The sad fact is the Iraqi Red Crescent organization, that's the same as the Red Cross in this country, and the UN reported last month that the number of Iraqis fleeing their homes has soared since the American troop increase began in February. The chart reports some decreases in the intensity of the ethno-sectarian violence in certain Baghdad districts. That's based on military data. But where there have been decreases, they are due largely to the fact that mixed Muslim areas are being overrun by either Shia or Sunni enclaves. The Shia have been gradually taking over all of Baghdad, wiping out Sunni communities that stood in their path. Over at the Center for American Progress, analyst Brian Katulis estimated that Baghdad, which once used to be 65% Sunni majority city, is now 75% Shia. It tells you a lot about displaced people. A huge proportion of the 1.5 million Iraqi refugees in Damascus, Syria, was displaced during 2007. That was a side effect of Bush's surge.
So all of this involves protecting the Iraqi people. How exactly? Just more spin from Bush. I think if he says it enough that we're winning this war and that his surge is working and all that, maybe he believes it. Maybe he thinks other people will believe it as well, and obviously some people do. Maybe he thinks the Iraqis are safer when they're refugees in a foreign country. I'll tell you something. I don't think that was his, seventh State of the Union speech last night. I don't think there's ever been a president that'll be missed less than this man. I don't think there ever be a bigger sigh of relief in this country that a man is leaving the Oval Office than this man. The scary thing is, will they be installing another one just like him right afterwards? Does the American public have the ability, have the smarts, call it what you will, to go ahead and turn these people out of office completely? Will they do it? Can only hope so. It's got to be done. And let's face it, we do have four guys running for the presidency right now on the Republican side of the ledger that will do no more than walk into that Oval Office and continue the same damn policies that we're living under right now. I don't think there's any question about that. I don't know how you could think anything else. I honestly don't. So, wake up, America. Understand what we're dealing with here. America was dumb enough to elect George Bush for a second term. I hope they're not dumb enough to put another George Bush type in the Oval Office following him. I sure hope. Thanks for listening to the program today. Appreciate it very much. We'll be back tomorrow from 3 to 5 with more of the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. And don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Later, gang.
Now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. We all know the words the media uses when discussing John McCain. Maverick, they call him. A straight talker, a moderate, a reformer. This is the guy who's the POW, the war hero. But what is the truth about John McCain? Is he as much of a maverick as the press says? Chris Matthews once famously said that the media loves John McCain so much they are his base. And certainly in this 2008 election season, we have seen John McCain treated with kid gloves. But what is the truth? Is he a straight talker? Does he flip-flop on issues from taxes to the war in Iraq, from Jerry Falwell to immigration, from abortion to such mundane things is ethanol? Is he a conservative? Is he a liberal? Does he have a lot of ties to lobbyists, the big business interests that have financed the Bush administration as well? To answer all these questions, I've invited Paul Waldman on the show. He is the co-author with David Brock of Free Ride, John McCain and the Media. Paul, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, let me start with all the the things that the media says about John McCain. Is it fair to say that John McCain is better treated than other politicians? I mean, doesn't the media praise other politicians?
I don't think there's any question that nobody has gotten the kind of sustained positive coverage that he has over the years. Other candidates and other politicians will get periods of good coverage and periods of bad coverage, times when they're up, times when they're down. The difference with John McCain is not just in the character of his coverage, which we're going to talk about, but also the fact that it's almost uninterrupted in its positivity. He's really seen for the last 10 or 12 years or so a kind of sustained wave of just positive coverage that building up this image of him that is precisely what he and his advisors want to create. So in the end, the press became almost partners with him in creating that image. Most of the things that are involved in that image are either wildly exaggerated or just outright false. There's nobody who has kind of fracked the media code in the same way that John McCain has and gotten them on his side.
And we'll get to the details of all the things the media has false. But let me just ask you in general. No one would claim the media has been friendly to, say, Hillary Clinton, or even, for that matter, to Mitt Romney. But how about Barack Obama? At least until the Jeremiah Wright affair, it seems that he was getting sustained positive coverage. How would you compare Obama's coverage with McCain's?
Well, I think if you look over the course of this campaign, Obama has had some ups and some downs. There's certainly no question that he had periods of good coverage, especially when he was winning, and that's generally what you see. Since the political reporters look at almost everything through the perspective of that sort of who's up and who's down, tracking the poll results kind of thing, when a candidate wins